Ella Massa is on one of the biggest journeys of her life right now. The former Wolfsburg, PSG and FC Rosengard forward is currently getting to grips with being a mum for the very first time, alongside her partner, Real Madrid defender Barbet Peter. Their son was born earlier in September, and just as with any new parents, it's sure to be a challenge, particularly with the small matter of a global pandemic still going on in the background. But Massa has already experienced massive challenges in her life, from struggling to accept her own sexuality by the age of 25, to the difficulties presented in her teenage years where money was tight and her mum was battling with bipolar disorder. But throughout it all, Massa has always held on during the tough times for that light at the end of the tunnel. We spoke on this podcast a matter of days before the US international was due to give birth. The couple's home was fully prepared for their new arrival, and it's clear just how much the 34-year-old has learnt from her incredible life experiences already. This is the Women's Football Diary with Ella Massa. Ella, welcome to the podcast and welcome to our show. Thank you so much for taking some time out and being our guest today. Usually I start by asking how whoever it is we have on is on that particular day, but I think there's probably a very obvious starting point in that you are essentially due to give birth any day now.
Yes, it would be an awkward podcast if all of a sudden my water breaks, which is good. It actually could happen.
You mentioned that before. Imagine if, you know, in half an hour's time.
Then that hopefully you'll get a little bit more likes here. You know, if I can say, oh, this was the time. It's your voice that my son heard that he was like, I'm ready to come to the world.
No child needs to hear that. first and foremost, how is everything in terms of the excitement? Daunting at the same time, probably every other emotion under the sun.
I think you're never prepared. You know, this is something as an athlete or as just a human being, you can say, I'm ready. You've read the books, the 9 months, you definitely want him out. But now that it's here, you're nervous, you're a bit scared. I don't understand the absolute scientific of how he's coming out of my body. I'll leave the details for the rest, but yeah, I mean, we're excited. We're ready. And like I said, in Spain the hour or two earlier, you know, supposedly the league was supposed to start next weekend on the 5th. And now there's no start date. We hope for October, but for them, it's really hard because they've had 2 or 3 months of preseason at Real Madrid. But for us, it's a little bit of a blessing because there's no real rush that he has to come out. She's not going away to play in 2 weeks, you know, so we've had a little bit of luck on that side.
Yeah, I was going to say that, in that your partner, Bobette, plays for Real Madrid. How's that uncertainty been in terms of when the season is starting? Has it affected things in terms of family and home life? Or is it just,
I just think it's annoying. I mean, I don't, you know, you guys in England, I have so much credit because you guys cover the sports. You know what the FAWSL is. You know, if this was ever happening and the men's games were starting and the women had no start date, and I just played the Champions League in England, you would think some news reports would be like, wait, hold on, this is a huge red flag. How is the Champions League being played in Bilbao? But yet the girls don't have a start date for their national league, where Barcelona, Atletico Madrid, these teams play in. I think you just don't hear anything. And I can understand that Spanish, I can go through the news and it's nowhere to be found. It's a really an interesting time. So I think it's just frustration and a bit of annoying, I guess. It doesn't make sense in my book, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, when you hear that, it does sound strange when consider everything that's going on. And even when the WSL did call quits on last season, there was already a start date put in the diary pretty much instantly. So it's weird that hasn't seemed to happen over in Spain.
Yeah, and they say that there's this protocol, like the protocol that all the leagues have to follow. And then I said, okay, well, if you knew in June that the league was going to be done, and then everybody goes on vacation in August in Madrid, it's like a thing in Spain. Like it's been like a zombie zone. There's no one in the streets in August in Madrid. And then if you knew that, why would you not do the protocol in July? So then the teams can follow it in August, so then they can start in September. Because now the rumor is that they're doing this protocol for the women's league, which is separate than the men's, which does also doesn't make sense. Okay, money for corona tests. But then once this protocol is in place, they have to wait 30 days before they play their first game. So now everything is pushed. And it's like, it just doesn't make sense why it was not prepared, because you knew a second wave was coming. You knew corona was here. And is it financial? Is it not? Just come out and be honest with it and try to find a solution and get some help, to be fair as well.
In terms of daily life as well, I mean, if anyone who's seen the last or most recent upload video on Doyen Sports YouTube channel, and you're still managing to go hiking, even though you're about to give birth, are you one of those people that just needs to keep active at all times?
I go to the gym 3 times a week. I have these 2 guys that meet me there. It's my only, it's like my sense of sanity. You know, otherwise I stay in the house. You know, I like I said, the 3 dogs you might hear later. But it's just such a weird time, like you said, with corona. It's not like I go get a coffee or something like that. So this is a way that going outside and being, granted it's 38 degrees here today, so you cannot go outside from 1 until 8 p.m. It's just not possible. But it's just, I need to do something to look forward to, because this weird thing of corona, you know, being pregnant, end days, I could sit at home on my couch all day and it sounds great, but after a certain time, and having a schedule, to be fair, as an athlete for most of my life, I mean, I've been told what to do for the last 20 years every day, you know? It's a really, really hard adjustment. I don't think corona helps it for anyone. I think a lot of people, not even athletes, can understand this right now. So it's just about a way of, like you said, going out for an hour to stimulate your mind, look at something different. And I haven't let the pregnancy get in the way yet. Boss isn't too happy, but... It's important. It saves your sanity a bit, I guess.
But I was going to say then, because we talked a little bit about it before we pressed the record button, mm-hmm. about how important sport has been. Has that, I suppose, break from reality? Has that been sport, and has that just shown how important it is to you?
Yeah, I think, I'm very vain. I will admit that. When you're in football, you have this like really thin line of like what your body's supposed to look like. And then as you get pregnant, you have to throw that to the wind. But for my mental state, to get up in the morning, I go to the gym at 11. I know I'm going to do this and my day can be a little bit more, you know, I have more energy and it's just a thing that gets me going. And it's just something I know every day I have control over and I can do it whether corona is here or not. And I think that's just important.
You mentioned or touched on rather the adjustment side of things from being an athlete to, you know, coming out of your career and things like that. What was the most difficult bit to adjust to? Is it just sort of everyday life now rather than that regimented training schedule?
I think the biggest thing was I didn't look at it when I said goodbye to playing football as the chapter closing, or I guess that the book was closed. It's just a new chapter. So I thought, to be fair, maybe this was my own detriment that we come to Spain, and of course this is me taking a year, 2 years for Bops's career, and sometimes in the family you have to do that. I mean, this is conversations like I told you about the U23 job, and I love coaching and I had a men's team there and it was something I really enjoyed in Germany. But when Real Madrid comes knocking, that many people say no, because no matter what, this is gonna, you know, prolong her career and it's gonna be really good for a resume, and we made this choice together. But I think I just didn't think that it would be so hard, one, to find a job in Spain. Two, I didn't think we'd get pregnant so fast. And three, I never saw corona happen. So I think the adjustment of all three has made it quite hard, because as long as I'm on a pitch, I have this sense of, it's always been my safeguard, it's been my place. I miss the locker room, I think, the most. And so that's been the hardest transition, is it just went from, okay, I had a team, I had coaching, this was a really good thing, I really enjoyed it. Okay, we come here, it's fine, I'm learning a new language. You know, you go from 5 hours of Spanish school every day, and then it just kind of went silent. So, and now it's picking back up. I got into my A license in Sweden. I start in October, which is going to be a huge reality thing for the baby being 6 weeks. But now I know, okay, I have something to look forward to again, because in May, I should have my A license again. I wish I was doing it in English, because German and then... Swedish A license, it can, but now I have something to study for and that kind of stuff. But it was a real dip. It was hard, honestly. It was quite hard to get through it.
Yeah, I think you summed up what quite a lot of people were going going through, whether it's football or not football, is just when everything stopped.
Exactly.
You know, probably a few weeks where everyone was just scrambling, going, what is going on? And how do you even start to manage things again? In terms of your coaching, are you almost the type of person that needs that next thing to look forward to?
I think it's just something to prepare for or to think outside yourself, because now, okay, it's not waking up and not doing anything or having a kid. It's like, okay, I have to study 2 hours of Swedish, you know, and then, okay, I know that I have to find this team that I can coach so that I can do my A license. And then I know, okay, in May, at the end of Pasta's contract is up in May. We hope she stays in a year. I mean, it's her choice, but then, you know, the A license is the second highest license to a pro. And so I know that I'm also doing something for my career here as well. So I think it's just about having some goals and objectives, and not only just being a mom, because for me, it's been really hard to be a mom, and I'm not even a mom yet, but just to have something else that is my own time and is something that pushes me personally as well as my family, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said at the start, you can read all the books, but nothing's actually going to prepare you for when it all finally happens and comes together.
Exactly.
I think people will probably already gauge from the answers so far that family is quite important to you. And kind of rewinding back to your teenage years, and we're going to put a bit more context on it all, really.
Okay.
But if you go back to your teenage years and just read through it, there's a lot going on really for you to deal with at that young age, particularly your mum's health and figuring things out when you were, 14, I think. How do you explain to someone, kind of in a nutshell, how that time in your life was, and I suppose the challenges of growing up in that environment?
I think as a 14-year-old kid, at teenage years, when people, for example, ask me about what I'm most worried about my son, I think being a teenager is hard, you know? That's what I'm most scared of now, is coming into a momhood. And now I realize, going back, I was angry, you know, like teenage. I was so lucky because we come from a small town. So I was a footballer. So I was, you know, no one really saw me as a crazy mom. But at the same time, like, I was still cool because I had football. You know, if I was on the other side and didn't have a sport where people identified me with, maybe I would have been really bullied. Maybe I would have had, because, you know, my mom would come to my basketball games and she would tap dance on the floor. You know, it went in with, and now I can laugh about it. But at that time, at 14 years old, you're like, you're in high school, 14 to 18 in the States, seniors, juniors, sophomore, you're a freshman. And you don't understand that it's a chemical imbalance. You just think your mom's trying to embarrass you. Yeah, I think I was angry, but I think football was a huge outlet. And like I told you before, it was my saving grace and where I put my shoes on, and I was a normal kid.
Was it almost your identity to some extent?
Absolutely. My whole life, I think it's been my identity, because all the crazy stuff that's gone in my life, it was a time where no matter what was going on the outside, I crossed the white line. And then, you know, it was 90 minutes, 2 hours where everything was normal and I understood it and I could push my body and my mind to the limit.
How, it's probably a lot easier said than done, that. And that, how do you actually balance that footballing driven side of you versus everything that's going on at home as well? Because it sounds to me, on the outside looking in, that it could be one hell of a juggling act.
Yeah. I think football was my psychiatrist. You know, when I really look at it, it was talking to my mom about it the other day. You know, she's like, I think everyone should see a psychiatrist and talk to him, and I'm working with mine. And I said, listen, I think it's great that you ask for help and that people are getting it. I think it's really important. My twin sister is a counselor, you know, like, I think it's really important. But for me, how football helped me was, it was that moment where I had all this anger I didn't understand. And then instead of holding onto it and keeping it, I would go on the pitch, maybe get a yellow card or run myself into the ground. But after I walked off that pitch, it wasn't inside me anymore. It was my hour and a half therapy session, because I could do what I need to do, let it all go on the field. And then when I stepped off the pitch, I was okay. So I think that was just the way that I learned to deal with it from a really young age. And I don't know if it's healthy or not, but I didn't have anything after that time to hold on to anymore. It was gone. Or some of it was gone. Of course, you go home, you get hit with the reality of, oh crap, what's going on? But for that moment, I was free and I didn't have a weight. And then it was maybe a 5 kilo weight on my shoulders instead of a 20.
Yeah, it sums up what we were talking about before in terms of the release and how important it is just to let some of that weight off, like you were talking about. That's far easier to deal with a 5 kilo weight than a 20 kilo weight. Yeah. How much of an inspiration is your mom?
Now she's a lot more. When I was younger, I have to say it was, there were some times, I mean, if there's anyone that could put me in a room and get me upset in 3 minutes, it's my mother. It's a really unique, and it's like not a little angry, it's huge, it's like explosive. But now what she's gone through and talking to, excuse me, and seeing the step that she's making, she's still trying at 70. She'll always be my inspiration. I mean, people can say what they want to say about her being crazy, but you know, her four kids are a mom of four, you know, a dad of three, an engineer, almost, you know, very wealthy, a twin sister who's a counselor, you know, a pro athlete for 10 years. So she did something right. She let us find out who we were and how we were going to be in her own unique way. But I find myself now thinking of those lessons and saying, okay, I'm going to take that, because in that time, she really loved us to the end and she just did the best she could.
And I know we've all got the benefit of hindsight, and you've talked about this before, but now that you're essentially about to become a mum yourself, has that, sort of the thoughts you had before, has that again kind of influenced how you think you'll end up being a mum to your son?
Yeah, I think being with a German put a little bit more structure than I was on, for sure. I mean, we've had the baby car seat for the last 3 weeks in the car. I came home in a laundry basket. So, you know, there's like a little bit of a line. Yeah, but I think absolutely. I mean, I think I want my mom, if Corona wasn't here, my mom would be here now. She'd be sitting right next to me, you know, but she's 70 and she's put her body through the fair share of special treats. So she's high risk. So unfortunately she can't be here, but otherwise there's no one else that I want my son to grow up and to see and to be around, because she is so fluid free and, you know, it's her world and there's lessons that he should learn that only she can teach through her own, again, unique way.
How have you seen attitudes to mental health change in that time, do you think?
I think it's more in the women's game or the men's game. It's like, it's okay to say I deal with anxiety. You know, when I came out in Sweden and said I dealt with anxiety for the first time, people were so astonished, or I got so much good feedback. And now when you see in the men's game, even more so, that they're coming out and saying these things, it's like, we all put our shoes on the same way. You know, I tweet about a Barcelona game, for example, what the coach did yesterday. I get 5 tweets about she needs to cala la boca, like shut her mouth, and what is she talking about? And it's just my opinion. Or Messi Ronaldo tweet that I did. And it was like, you would think I just tweeted Trump is the worst person in the universe, you know, but it went nuts. And I am no one compared to what these men probably have to go through. I think people forget that we're just human, you know, they have a wife, they have a husband, or, you know, like, well, not the men's players have a husband, but, you know, they have kids, and it hurts sometimes. So I think if people don't react to it, they must not be understanding that, again, we all put our shoes on the same way, and it's out there, and we need to speak about it more and more.
You have perfectly summed up Twitter right there, and social media in a nutshell.
It's really crazy. They don't follow you. Or they do follow you, and they follow you because, you know, I want to speak about, like, Annie Aluko. I mean, you can say now the Aston Villa manager, like, she's controversial. But if you don't like what she says, don't follow her. But that's not how it works. You have these trolls and people that sit behind. I remember seeing something last week, like, somebody commented on my Instagram of Box's smile. And I got so infuriated. I'm like, do you have any idea what she had to go through and her face is actually paralyzed? You son of a, like, I can take it, but when you talk about people I really care about, and it's like, they have no idea. I mean, I deleted the comment, blocked them, but, and Box is okay with it, but it's like, they have no idea how much their words can hurt.
Exactly. It's something I've always noticed as well, first and foremost in my job, because I have to moderate Facebook comments and things like that, which some of them are just beyond belief a lot of the time. But then if I'm looking at football specific examples and I look at the amount of flack on Twitter that some of the female writers get versus some of the male writers like myself, and it's almost polar opposites just for putting out your opinion, essentially. That Instagram example you just mentioned, again, yeah, kind of sums up what I was saying about family and how important it is to you, in that it sounds like when people do say what they say and it's not particularly nice or anything like that, it's you sound like the person who's always the first to defend your family, your friend, whoever might be the target for it, if that's fair to say.
Yeah. I just think it's so rude. Like, I have a tough skin because I've had to deal with the comments about being gay or out, or, you know, even a divorcee, I was very open with my personal life that, you know, maybe I regret, because, like I said, we're not men's players, but I still got my fair comment of how could you do that, you know, when I came gay, how could you be with a woman, religious, and then, you know, when my personal life was on blast of getting divorced and then being with another footballer, and, you know, I've had to fight with Bops about just being these videos about our private life of the baby, because for her, she's very private, and for her, this is showing a very personal side. But I think it's just, like I said, I can take it, but as soon as you go after someone that I love or care about, or even if you don't, I think it's, who gave you the right to say anything that would hurt somebody else? And I know that because I've done it before. You know, I've done it when I was a kid and saying, okay, you can't be gay, it's religiously wrong. I've learned from my mistakes and the judgment that you have no idea how deep words can hurt people. So I've learned out of my own mistakes to be a little bit more careful, maybe a little bit more supportive, and try to know, okay, my story, for even if it's a quick moment, one person hears this, it saves one person, then it's worth my own embarrassment or shame or whatever you want to say it is.
Is it daunting putting some of your private life out there? It's something most people don't have to contend with.
Yeah, I think so. I think you still look at the comments. You still want to know who liked or not. I mean, it's just, I think it's human nature for you want everyone to like you. You know, it's just a personal thing, or it's taken, obviously, in the limelight when you're doing this for 10 years, it gets a little bit easier each year. And then you hit to a point where, listen, this is my life. I'm going to live it. If you don't like it, don't follow. So I think I'm more there, but I think also if I go into the coaching realm, you have to be a little bit more careful with a lot of things and what you say, because you'll get a lot, like you said, a lot more slack. But for me, you just hit a point where it's like, okay, this is me. This is my life. I'm 34. Let's get on. Let's move forward.
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, you've obviously got the benefit of sort of being in the game for quite some time, but then it always strikes me as a particular challenge that someone who's maybe newer in the game or has just joined a professional outfit, something like that, and then suddenly have to deal with this on top of performing and playing. And
I also think I've been in the game where I'm also at the end of it, you know, like now you see these young girls coming at 22, 23, they're pretty face, they're a decent footballer, and they have a million followers. I mean, that just didn't happen even a year ago. So they also get a lot of slack. They also get a lot of comments, and it's not always the nice, pretty of, you know, it's hard. A lot of people block comments for this reason. It's not an easy lifestyle. You know, people say, careful what you wish for when you become famous. I'm not famous, but it is a thing that your life is on blast. I can go to coffee with my partner and my kid, and I don't have to cover a face. I can just go do that. But a lot of people can, and it's not what you think it is, I don't think.
Definitely.
Actually, I know so from talking to many people that are their life like that.
Sticking on the mental health side of things, is there more that needs to be done to, I suppose, understand people's situations, and specifically with the social media thing? I've asked people this before, whether there needs to be more, not necessarily policing, but background checks on accounts, just better monitoring from the social media giants on a whole.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if I'm a coach, I'm going to make sure, and I have the budget, I will make sure I have a sports psychologist. because I just, or just as I call it in general, and maybe the girls don't have to use them. I don't want to know, but you know, at least once a year, the same as when they come in, they do a physical test. They have to sit down and talk to this person just because, like we were talking about earlier, everybody has such these unique stories, and you never know when you're on a high your life or low, because whether you're, even if you win the Champions League trophy, you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes. So I think it's definitely something we need to talk about more, and I think we just need to normalize it. The more the men players talk about it, unfortunately, allows everybody else to talk about it more, and then it becomes just a thing of, okay, wow, these people are human, they're not weak. It's just a mental thing, and that they have to push through it, or they need help.
It's one of the reasons why I've always admired Fran Kirby so much for being as open as she is.
Exactly.
What she's gone through with her mum's death, and even when she's there winning trophies, there's always that in the background that she's been so open about. Yeah. Just explaining exactly what you said, it's not linear. Sometimes the highs do come with the lows at the same time.
Yeah, and imagine if a men's player would come out and say that. I mean, he would definitely have a lot of support, but he would also have, you know, how many thousands of comments of, okay, man, who cares? Let's go. Don't be a, see, you know, this is like, you know, it's just, it's not, it needs someone to take a really brave step, unfortunately. And then as it continues, the friends, these people that talk about it, then it just starts to become, okay, let's talk about it. They do their job, that's great, and let's rally behind them.
Yeah, the normalization, really.
Exactly.
The conversation is so, so important. We haven't touched on your dad yet and his influence as well. So it was, what, 2011, I think he sadly died while you're at PSG. And there's the really nice video of him doing the dribbling through the cards, which is, like, if anyone hasn't seen it, I urge people to go and find it. Again, how much of an influence was he on your life?
I mean, he was the reason I got to where I was in my career, because after he passed, you know, I was going to retire. And then I think he was instrumental with me keep going, because that was my moment with my dad. And I never thought at 32, 33, I would be, you know, part of a team in a Champions League final. Or, you know, I joke, my last year and a half of football, I added, you know, 6 trophies at 33. That's with a non-national team player. That's something that only I think he could have orchestrated and be laughing upon, you know, the stubborn side. But again, you know, we talk about my mom and my father. It wasn't always easy. It wasn't smooth. It was him coming over when I shot that video and me saying, like, listen, Dad, I'm sorry. I didn't understand. I pushed you away. Thank you for always coming to my games and supporting me. And I had my moment to forgive him. And I'm so thankful that happened, because a lot of people don't.
That willingness to drive as well. I mean, how close was it to packing it in and then pushing on again to keep playing?
I mean, for example, when I came home from his funeral that summer, because he passed in October, and then I came home for the week, and PSG was so great, they let me go home. I mean, I flew back a week later to play Lyon in a championship game. I knew my dad wanted me there. And then when you're in Paris from November until June, you're not thinking, oh, this is the last place I had coffee with my dad. And then when I came home in June and I saw my family's in shambles, you know, they don't know how to handle my dad, I knew I had to come home, and PSG again was so great. But at 25, that was like a really turning point in my career, because I thought, I'm playing for PSG, Champions League, and now I've decided to go home for my family. And then I came home and I wanted to play and win the WSL trophy, like not the NWSL, so the in-between the WPS and NWSL. And then I tore my hamstring in this game the day before his celebration. And then if that wouldn't have happened, who knows? I think if we would have won it, I would have retired at 25 and wouldn't have played 8 years more. So I think it was just, sometimes you think you have this plan and this is exactly how it's going to go, and then you're just humbly reminded you have no idea how your life is supposed to work out.
that's such a good message to send out, because how many people have plans?
Yeah, and I think now, I mean, even though you have this plan, you have this, and then Corona hits, which is this incredible beast of a disease, and then, you know, you're followed in. I know in England, so many of you guys are, you know, fighting to just simply keep a job, and it's, what are you supposed to do? You're on your way to tenure or whatever you're doing, and it's just such a, in the times where it's hard, I just can't tell you enough. It's like, I would always hold on to hope when it's hard, because I know that at the end of a valley, it will come up. And I think there's just so many of us in the valley right now trying to grasp to find a way to take a step to come up.
So many similar themes, I think, across the board of what people are going through right now. And you can easily relate it to stuff that's happened in the past as well.
Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for @SportspielPod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram.
Moving on to specifically talk about your faith, which you touched on a couple of moments, a moment ago. And for people who might not be in the know, just how important is your faith to you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's gone up and down in my life. I mean, I went from 16, like, Pops actually does not believe me, for the record, that for like a good 8 years, I didn't drink, I didn't have sex. Like, she does not believe one word that comes out of my mouth. And I tell her, like, listen, I was a Bible, like, belt chaser. This was my life. And then I think when I kind of got out of my hometown and started to realize, and then I lost my father, and I had so much, again, anger kind of come up, like, I didn't get to say goodbye. Why would you take him? I've been through so much. It really kind of went down again. But now I think my God, or who I talk to, is my dad. And I do believe in that. At the end of the day, I'd rather hope that, you know, God or Jesus or dad is up there, that I believe in the good of people and the good of the world, and then find out at the end of the day, okay, there's nothing, then on the other side of the coin. So I think I had a hard journey, and I made a lot of mistakes, hurt a lot of people, but at the same time, I know I had to go through those to be where I am today and to have a better understanding. There is absolutely no judgment in my life anymore. There's no, I can't say, no one gets married to get divorced. You know, like, someone can come tell me I was sleeping with a guy and he has two kids and his wife. And, you know, of course I will tell them my opinion, but I have learned, I come to you like this, let me tell you, and I will help you in any way possible. And for me, that is what religion should be. There's no stones. There's no white fancy gate. It's you come with me with open arms, a problem, and I try my best to say, listen, I'm going to hold you accountable, but let's try to find a way to solve this together. You're not alone.
And I kind of asked that as well to put a bit of context on essentially your coming out journey. Again, something you've touched on a little bit. And I suppose how tough was it accepting yourself when you kind of have it pre-programmed in your head, all of these ideas that I suppose you haven't realized it's okay to feel this way and it's okay to be this way at that point in your life?
I think still at 34, with having a same-sex partner and a baby on the way, I still think I deal with a little bit of it. I mean, I can't say I'll go outside in Madrid and hold Bob's hand. If I was with a guy, would I do the same? It wouldn't even be a thought. So I'm completely accepted. I'm so proud that she's mine. I'm so proud of this journey. But at the same time, it takes a lot of time to undo those scars that you have physically and maybe not even so understanding emotionally engraved in your body. And I think now, compared to 5 years ago, and especially in Europe, it's a lot more of an open world. You know, if I tweet something about here, it's a lot more accepted than if my American followers, a lot of them, you know, comment, because it's still such a battle with religion and what's right, I would say. I think more than many places, and I think also East Europe, you know, the Middle East I'm not worried about dying, you know, and there they're still being persecuted for being gay. I mean, this is still 2020. Things going on in the world. So I think you really have to deal with it and accept it, but I don't know if it will ever be fully accepted. But at the same time, I know I am the way I am, and I will never feel ashamed for loving someone again in my life.
What was that, how the, I suppose, the initial battle in your head was going, and that there was a sense of being ashamed?
Yeah, guilt, a shame. Why can't I be normal? Why am I I have this amazing guy that was my boyfriend for, you know, 8 years, 10 years on and off. And he is like, he was incredible, a pastor's son, a really good guy. And I want to love him, you know, I want to be, but then I fell in love with this, you know, this girl in college, and it was like my whole world opened, the emotional roller coaster. And I felt so much in more intimate times, you know, my eyes were opened. But I felt that feeling because I thought, okay, this isn't right. I'm not supposed to, doesn't make sense in any form that I'm with her, but something, and again, I think it's the way my family raised me, was I have to fight for what I believe in, even if it doesn't feel natural to me.
Mm-hmm. That, I suppose, what your family taught you versus the town where you grew up and what the town taught you. Is there almost a conflict there?
I think it was just certain part. It was where I felt at 16, because, you know, like I said, at 14, I had this athlete and I had this great thing. But when I'd come home, you know, my mom was in an institution. My brother and sister were out. So it was me and my twin sister. We were on food stamps. It didn't make sense. We didn't have new clothes. You know, I'd have people drop me off two houses down because I was ashamed that our house was falling apart. And then I met this guy at 16. And he's like, I don't care. Listen, God makes you new. He makes you perfect. He makes you lovely. No one judges you. Like, you have a chance to a whole new life. So for once, it made sense outside the football pitch to me. I felt accepted and loved. And they didn't care about my mom. They didn't care I was poor. They could see me for me. And they supported me. And they loved me. And they were also a personal training gym, so I could also go there. And it was just a mix of feeling really loved and accepted for the first time, which I hadn't really felt for just being this emotional roller coaster, you know? So I think it was just of timing and mixture. And then it took me a long time to realize, okay, I maybe put more faith in their family and that section of town than my own. But now when I look back, I realize how lucky I was that my mom loved me no matter what. My family has supported me through everything. And, you know, I have my mom, we joke about it. My mom has a black son-in-law. She has four mixed grandchildren, and she has a gay daughter. For her, this is like her dream, you know? And, you know, 20 years ago, that wasn't a dream that was so accepted in somewhat of the South of America.
Was there a turning point where you kind of realized it was okay to accept yourself, or you accepted yourself?
Or was it gradual? I mean, at 25, I was still with this guy, you know, so that shows you the timeline of up. And in this time in between, I was with a girl, and I told him, and we were trying to work it out, and he was in school. But I think at 25, when I came home and my dad passed away suddenly, it was just like, okay, Ella, you're going back to Paris. You got to figure out who you are and what you're going to be. And, you know, it wasn't an easy thing, but at 25, it's somewhat late. And then I started to finally accept myself. And, you know, then at 27, I met Aaron, my ex-wife, you know, so it was a later transition. But I joke with players that I played with, a Formiga, Cristiani, Megan Rapinoe. They're like, Ella, at 22, we were giving you crap that you were gay. Like, they would really joke in front of the guy I was with, like, come on, Ella, we know you're gay, you know? And I would be like, no, guys, there's no chance. But now we can laugh about it, because when you look back, I was like, wow, there was a lot of signs, you know?
That's a big question to ask yourself at 25 as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's also more normalized in women's football. Who knows if I went and worked in the, if I retired at 25, I'd probably be at home, maybe with this guy, having kids, you know? But it was more of an accepted time at that point, because you're around it in football. And again, it's not accepted in Europe, but in the US, you still had these role models that said, listen, it's okay to be gay, Ella. Megan Rapinoe, it's okay to be gay. It's not a problem, Cristiani. Ella, it's okay. It's not a problem. We love you. We accept you. Don't fight it, you know? But I wasn't ready to accept it at that point.
Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to obviously accepting it and then making it public, is that almost that's another massive step to take when, you know, just a few years before you weren't accepting of it yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a secret for a long time. And then again, it wasn't because someone came at me, but it was someone, you know, very religious and close to me came at Aaron. And then that was my thing of, again, maybe get myself in trouble, be calm, but okay, you can't say that about her, because I really care and I love her and I think she's an incredible human being, and no one should change that because they're just with a woman. Mm-hmm. That was my coming out, I guess, in a way.
And that, going back to faith, that to me, there's, I think, probably a few people who, again, see it as this rigid concept.
Yeah.
But it's like you're the perfect example in that it's open to interpretation, how you interpret it, but there's probably some, how should I phrase it, sort of some key values that you can take from it regardless.
Yeah, I mean, I think mine has really adapted over the, you know, over the time of what, I mean, do I believe in the Ten Commandments? I mean, they say, first and foremost, you can't pick and choose what you believe in the Bible. But my point is that this Bible has been translated and passed down for thousands of years. So who knows, regardless of what the theologians say, what did it actually say? I mean, technically, you could have slaves still in the Bible if you really want to take it word for word. And I am no Bible guru. I don't understand everything that says, but for me, it's, if you accepted a lot of what the Bible said, it's, they just focus on certain parts and not all of it as well when they try to teach what's correct and what's not. And that's my problem. So I choose to take the good sides of the stories about how Jesus came back and they said, who cast the first stone? For me, that was what God is. And it's not so much the black and white, it's the gray, because the Bible is very gray. There is no one that can tell me in my eyes, no, this is exactly right. Okay, well, what about the 10 other translations that change one word that can really change from an orgy to being gay? One word can change these three things to a very different dynamic. So I think I've kind of choose everything to make, I don't know, I guess the world maybe a better place. And I think, again, that goes to my mom. I don't care if you believe in Buddha or Allah, you know, if you make the world a better place, then your religion is fine by me.
That, well, again, is a perfect message to get behind, but it does sum up the world pretty much in that it's not black and white, it's grey. Yeah,
exactly.
There's so much going on at the exact same time. For anyone else who might be going through struggles accepting themselves, whether it's a sexuality thing or anything like that, and I'm sure there's plenty of people, I'm going to say, like, probably quite a few people have gone to university, gone to college, and have met someone who's probably going through a similar sort of struggle.
Yeah.
Any kind of advice that's worked for you or you think can help people go on that journey to accepting themselves in the same way that you did?
I would say, hold on. I think that's the biggest thing, is it's regardless of what situation you're going through or you think that you're alone and you're alienated, you have to hold on, because whether it's going through that you don't want to be this person that you're in love with, or if you know you don't have a job or school or whatever, it's like there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And there is someone out there that loves you, for you, 100% for you, and that is meant just for you. You just have to hold on and believe that he or she is out there, because sometimes I think love is the most trickiest thing in the world that can, you know, it's not so easy to fix like the rest. You can be poor, you cannot have money, but when you have a broken heart, that's the hardest point of your life. But hold on, because I promise you they are out there, and you just have to see that light, because I think it can get really dark sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've been asked this question multiple times, but it's often been mentioned, the whole lack of gay players on the men's side of the game. And whether, is it the environment, do you think, that's possibly the reason behind that as to why so many players don't feel comfortable putting it out there?
I think first and foremost, if people think that there's not gay players, for maybe not as many, but if there's not in the EPL, for example, at least 20, 30 gay men's players, then you're quite daft. And it's just unfortunate these guys can't live the life that they want to live and love the person they want to live and open until the end. So I think it takes a big player to come out and to say it, and maybe while he is playing, but they know in the locker room, folks, people know, it's just, they want to choose to be private because unfortunately they live on this platform where they are scrutinized, even if they have a wife, for the things on the pitch. And sometimes it's just not worth the battle for them to have a little bit of personal joy and happiness.
Yeah. And sums up exactly like we were saying, if you've got all that going on the side, as well as being scrutinized so intensely for your performances and every aspect of your training and your social life on social media. It's just, it can become so much when you put all that together.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, I mean, look at, for example, who's Instagram? I was looking at James Milner. I think he's a funny guy, but he doesn't have anything about his wife or his kids, or actually don't even know. I think he has kids, but I mean, these men really, I think now just put a profi side and then they have their personal life, just because I think it's just too much to handle and they want to have some type of privacy and saying, this is my life. This is, I don't need someone like James Vardy, people commenting about his daughter. What the hell is wrong with you? You know, it's like, it's just things like this that you think there's no way it would ever possibly happen. And then they're scrutinized and they're put on these platforms where anything is a go and no one should have to go through that.
Yeah, it's something I've always been uncomfortable with in terms of celebrity culture and how so much is scrutinized to such an abnormal level and every aspect of that life.
Exactly. I think Corona's also been humbling for them, because for us, the women's game, is it that big of a difference when you don't have 2,000 fans cheering you on? Maybe. But for the men's, I think they've really had to go through like, okay, wow, this is playing football in front of not 80,000 people. The transfer market, you go from what was normal of 200 or 150 euros paying for someone, and now it's like, oh, he's only going for 80 million. I'm like, you're still going for 80 million euros. I mean, it's like some part of normalcy has to come back into the aspect of football, which I think might be a good thing of Corona, because it revamps, like, for example, De Bruyne saying, okay, I was going to retire in 2 years. Now I want to play another 3 years, because I think now it's a little bit more humanized.
Yeah, it's almost like it's pushed a reset button of sorts.
Exactly. Which was needed, because it was getting out of control. I mean, it is out of control.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at some of the finances getting thrown around in the men's game, it is just, you can't.
If I had the career that I had, I could be on my private jet flying back to the US. And this is not a national team, it's just playing a year PSG, winning the league, I was with Babette and I was like, how much do you think these guys get for winning the Champions League just upon their salaries? 250, 500? I mean, you have these numbers that would just be extraordinary for the women's game, and it's just not that way yet. It's getting there, but there's a long way to go.
Yeah, exactly. And like you mentioned before, I think before we started recording as well, the wage you got offered for the Wolfsburg coaching role. And again, sums up the disparity in both sides.
This is the Women's Football Diary by Sportspiel, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's chat about your career. We'll take it away from some of the serious side for a bit, and it's full of highlights, let's be honest, because there's the PSG stint, Chicago Red Stars, Wolfsburg winning titles as well, among many other things. But if you can pick out some key highlights, if that's easy to do, any standout in particular?
I mean, I think Wolfsburg was very special and unique, because it was the first time in my career where I could really save money and put money aside, and playing Champions League and just having, that was definitely probably one of the best teams I've ever played for. I mean, we had 10 or 11 different national team captains on one team. I mean, that's just such a unique experience, and they've been great for so long. I think being the captain of Houston Dash, that was also a huge honor, because you had, you know, Carly Lloyd there and you had these incredible players, and to try to navigate of being a captain. PSG is always an honor, because, I mean, it's PSG. It's one of the most incredible clubs or known clubs in the world, you know. But I think it's more the hard times, I think, getting through the surgeries or coming back. Of course, the competitions and the games, because before Wolfsburg or Rosengard, I mean, I didn't have much trophies to my name, you know. So I don't really remember the trophies. It's just more about the times of coming back and defeats. Or in college, I remember we came back and beat Penn State 3-2. And for, you know, beating Penn State at that time, these were the moments that I think I hold dear compared to the rest.
Yeah. It was almost like the comebacks, both on the pitch and off the pitch, that I suppose you are rightly so proud of, because of the amount of effort it took to get there.
Yeah, and I mean, we joke about it, but if I go through these two rooms into our kitchen, there's, in our third room, Bops has a gold medal, a bronze medal, and the FIFA World Cup just sitting there. Like, the actual FIFA World Cup, they got it from 2007. And next to that, I have my little plaque saying I was player of the game in Sweden Rosengard in 2017. You know, it's like, that's my little sheet of paper. It was probably $5.99. But that's, for me, what I earned, and I know that I've earned, and it was great by me, and she's really supportive. But it's just, I thought I was a true professional and earned all this stuff, but I have nothing compared to what she's done. But it's just, it means a lot to me, and I've kept it for 3 years. It's my Olympics, my World Cup.
It's, everyone's got the same as well. I've got my fencing gold medal from Scottish Student Sport above.
See, there you go.
It's not quite the same level, but it's still mine. I can totally sympathise. Some sort of quick fire questions, really.
Okay.
Best player you've played with?
Formiga. Hands down. I mean, 42 years old. Who knows if she'll play tonight, but she was the one that I saw her mark Marta, and she's not fast. She's not anything, but she's just so intelligent. That she could change a game,
and she's still going as well.
I can't believe it. I'm sorry, I'd be like, Fufi, you are a legend. I mean, she will be one of the great. I don't think anyone will ever pass her, because what she's done, what, 6 World Cups. I mean, it's just, there's too many athletes now that will be able to do and play at 42. She's incredible.
Yeah, and to keep performing at the top of her game,
exactly,
as long as she has, is just stunning. Quite simply. Most underrated player you've played with?
Ooh, underrated, that's a good one.
That's always a tough one for people.
I think Babette is very underrated. I think I'm also biased, but I think for what she's achieved and how they handled her with the national team and coming here and her professionalism and how hard she works. I mean, she was always in it. She was always on the cusp. I mean, she has... I think only Bastian Schweinsteiger has won more than her. She's won like 9 or 8 German titles, Pokals. But when I see the dedication and what she does and what she brings to a team, I think people throw her off before they give her the chance. And I think she deserves more.
I mean, you can say, well, like you said, when you tally up what she's won.
And for a reason, you know, but she's always the one that's kind of always behind the scenes. And I think Real Madrid has been really good for coming here, because she feels, again, appreciated, and she can show, because the German mentality is so much different than the Spanish mentality.
But I suppose a lot you can learn from each one, really.
For sure.
What's been your biggest challenge in football?
Telling myself that I deserve it. I think I've always had this chip on my shoulder that, you know, as a walk-in at Illinois and then U23s, then national team, and then got injured, and then my dad, like, and then when I got to Wolfsburg and Rosengard, you know, Rosengard didn't want me. They only wanted Aaron, and then I had to pay for my own flight out there. And then I ended up, you know, being top goal scorer for 2 years in a row with players like Lika Martins and Marta, you know, some of the best forwards in the world. And just looking at myself in the mirror, Anya Mittag, Lotte Schelin, okay, wow, Ella, you're with the best. You deserve to be here. This is your time. Just take it. And I think that was my, like I said, the emotional, physical scars of just working to get there. I don't think when I actually got there, I just thought, okay, now I can enjoy it.
That's, to me, that's an interesting answer. Because when I ask that, it's always... Usually people answer with, say, an injury, a big injury that's come, they've fought back from, or they've been dropped from funding and they fought back from funding, or their performances weren't quite there. It's usually around that. But does that kind of mean, like, for a lot of your career, you were feeling that you weren't deserving of what you were getting?
I think I just didn't get what I thought I deserved. Or maybe I thought, you know, there's a chip on my shoulder when you come into national team. I wish I would have just known at 25, 24, what I do now, of being, I work hard, I do the little things. Okay, this is my time, show these girls that I'm worth it. You know, when I come into Rosengard on this thing and no one knew who I was, put that ball in the back of the net, this is your time. You know, like, I would go, different points, and I would always, it's almost like I had to be down to catch back up instead of when I was at the top, just being like, okay, wow, I'm okay to be here. I always thought something was coming that would put me back down, that I'd have to work myself back up.
Mm-hmm. Kind of whether they're real people or not, proving the doubters wrong a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is a two-part thing. From the start of your career versus the end of your career, what's been the biggest difference in you as a player, and what's been the biggest difference in you as a person?
From beginning to end, absolutely my technical ability. I mean, when I was started at 18, I would start my college career. I couldn't juggle the ball 10 times. I would more just like run straight off the pitch, you know? And now, like, I'm very proud of hitting left or right foot. I mean, I think it was something I really worked on, but I'm very proud of my technical ability. As a person, I would think as the no judgment. I mean, in women's football, the stories that you hear that go on privately are like, you could write like a chicken soup novel and people would never believe the stories that go on behind the scenes. And I'm sure it's the same in the men's, but I have learned very humbly I don't judge. It's none of my business. If they want to come talk to me about it, I will help. And to not go looking for trouble, you know, just to be, I've been through it, I understand it, and I'm here to help if you need me. If not, it's okay. So no judgment. I think I've really had to learn that the hard way.
Mm-hmm. Like you say, with so many high-pressured personalities, it's bound to happen in some way, shape, or form. So, like you say, benefit of hindsight.
A locker room full of women from 22 to 35, gay, straight, been together, haven't been together. I mean, you're asking for a disaster at sometimes. You know, it's like a season of emotional ups and downs. And that's why I think it's different from the men's and women's game, is that the men's, you can show up and do your job and, you know, they get on a fight on a pitch and they go in the locker room. They're like, let's go get a beer later. Women are a lot more emotional. And I think that you have to have some type of a unity to make a team a great. You can't just have great players. You have to have some type of a combination. You have to have some type of unity on the pitch and off the pitch in the women's game, in my opinion.
I'm going to fast forward on to kind of sexism in women's football. And this is essentially bearing in mind what came out in the BBC Sport Elite Sportswomen Survey at the start of this month, which I'm not sure if you got to see the results of that.
Okay.
Any of the particular highlights, but one of the key stats that came out of it, and that was a survey done by sportswomen in the UK, and 65% of respondents said they had experienced sexism in their sport, but only 10% said they'd reported it, which I think it's no surprise as to why that was such a striking finding of that survey. How prevalent, I suppose, specifically in football, is that issue? And does it feel like we've still got a way to go, bearing in mind sort of the experience you had at Magic Jack and what happened there?
Yeah, I think women are still not to the point where they think that they deserve it. I think we still think that we have to work for it and that we're not owed it. So these girls that play for, I don't know, Chelsea, you know, maybe it's gotten better, but I don't think they feel like they necessarily maybe deserve to be there, where the men's team, there's no question about their attitude or their cockiness. I mean, they know who they are, what they are, and how people should cater to them. So I think I said something in a different article. This one woman said, she's famous British, blonde hair, I'd have to come back, but she said, if I had a daughter, the first word that I would teach them is "fuck you." And I think that is, I mean, it's extreme, you know, but I think that that is also the mentality that we should have, is that it's not okay how we're treated. It's not something that we should be happy to be here. We deserve to be here. And I think that's the process that's changing. The men are already established in that, and the women will think, oh, if I say something, they're just going to get somebody else because, well, they can.
That sense of being worth it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because how many people have argued for so long about giving women's football the coverage and the recognition and the pay that they deserve? But it still seems like perhaps lower down or deeper down the ranks, there's almost a sense that you need that self-confidence to actually back yourself in situations like that.
And I think, like you said, I mean, if I was, who knows if it would be different if I was playing on a Chelsea bench and I was getting paid $1 million just to be there every month. Would I be upset if I'm not playing? Would I be upset if a coach said something this or not? Or would I just know that no matter what else I do in my life, I'm never going to get paid this amount of money? You know, like if a girl gets fired in a journalist company and she was making 10,000 grand a month, and then she thinks, oh, if I say something, how am I going to find this? Like, of course, they're not going to say as much of having just a financial security and backing. So I think there's just so many different aspects that go into that. And it's also about like the being able to stand up and say, okay, it is worth it and people will listen. And I don't think that the women's culture is like that, because if a woman walks in and she's cocky, girls will be like, oh, what's her deal? What's this? Instead of just saying, wow, okay, she's a badass. Respect to her. Let's get along with that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Does that, I suppose, culture need to shift in that direction? I suppose when you see what a lot of the US players are doing now, pay right, and so many people seem to be drawing inspiration from that, whether it's in terms of arguing for fair pay or at least believing in themselves a little bit more. Do we need more examples of that?
Yeah, I think it's just about being together and collective. And like, that's the thing about like creating community where, you know, you can't walk in and your boss can fire you without saying anything, that your community stands behind you. Like if there's a journalist, I don't know, community of women that say, okay, listen, that's not okay what your boss just did to you. You have to stand up and we'll support you. And I think that's what we kind of get more and more. And then of course, if the more women get into the head positions, that it will create a better environment where women are more respected. You know, I'm waiting for, we have a woman ref now in football. Okay, but why on the men's side is there not a woman coach? It doesn't make sense. Like, why can't a person be second or third to Klopp and to learn from him? And it's just a matter of a coach taking the first step, because my career is probably a lot more than these men's players, but why do they always get the opportunities more than a woman? Just don't look if it's a man or woman. Just look at the resume and say, oh, okay, she deserves a chance the same as the men does.
Mm-hmm. That's the same I've seen with punditry as well.
Yeah.
So many men's players can get parachuted straight on, but exactly. It's almost like a women's player has to fight for their opportunity, for that one shot to prove themselves.
They have to be the pretty, you know, on the side, and it's not just that they just know their stuff about how they're talking about football. It's just not the same yet.
Exactly. That survey, which I'm going to quote again because I just think it's been such an eye-opening set of results this week, and this specifically is looking at body image in women's sport, and the statistic here being that 78% of respondents said that they were conscious about their body image, which to me was like the big number in that these are elite sportswomen and they still are plagued by these problems, whether that's society putting on them, whatever it might be. I mean, is that something that you've seen in women's football, people being not so much caught up in that but thinking that way? Or I suppose does that then filter down to young girls when society is telling them this message, basically?
I think it took me a long, for example, I'm a little bit more of a short and stocky body. So in high school and stuff, I wasn't really celebrated for having biceps, you know, and it took like a little time for me to come out and to be like, listen, I work so hard for my body. I eat so well. Okay, not as well as probably should have, but I did what I need to do. So I should be able to show off my six pack. But you don't see many women footballers just training in their sports bras. Or when I do post, I did post a photo of my sports bra. Why do I get 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, whatever more likes? And it's almost shamed on in the women's game, where Sergio Ramos is always training with his shirt off or in, you know, not even shorts. He's just in his boxers. But it's completely normalized, where sometimes girls only get shown because they're playing football in their sports bras. Why? You know, I was sometimes with Bob, so I'm like, you work so hard for your body, why don't you like show it off? And she's like, no, I would never do that. This is my private thing. And I'm like, but you're a pro athlete, and every men's player, or most of them, show their work because this is how they're celebrated, you know? And I think there's just a really fine line for women of, okay, I'm showing my body off, or this is my own personal thing. You know, I don't need to show it to anyone.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how many times have we seen Cristiano Ronaldo's chest?
Every shirt, everything is with him. You know, but when his girlfriend does, okay, she's not an athlete, but it's like, it's more, I don't know if it's sexified, but it's just, you know, it's just a two-way street. There's no way that a woman's athlete is on the same line as a men's yet with this kind of stuff.
But we saw that the example I've mentioned a couple of times this week in interviews we've been doing is that the Irish rugby team unveiled their new shirt this week, and they got the men's players to model it and then drafted in models to do the women's shirt, for example.
Exactly.
Using the women's players, which to me was like the perfect example of how society is almost viewing two things completely differently.
I mean, it's also like, I mean, I was so happy that the Arsenal men have finally gotten women's players to do the jerseys, you know, because before they would have the models to do the jerseys, or Real Madrid, they have the men's do it, and it took a long time to get the women's to do it and not models. So I think it's, like you said, it's a long process, but it's also like, if you had a player like Ronaldinho, he's not the best looking guy, but if you had a woman's player that looked the same as Ronaldinho, would she have had the same, and plays the same, would she be as successful as he would be? I think it's still very much looks in the women's game. For trophies, for a lot of things, I think it's still very, very sexitized. I don't even know if that's a word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. What sort of message does that send to people watching the women's game? I suppose particularly if you're a young...
I think it's more to young girls. It's hard. You know, like, it's not just football, you're a great footballer. It takes to be on both sides. I think it's really good, for example, that you have someone that's off the different end of, you know, like, you can't be mad at these girls that they're beautiful, and Alex Morgan, Leika Martins, you know, it's not the thing. It's just, it's nice now that you also have a Megan Rapinoe, a different look, a more edgy look, you know, and it's, unfortunately, we're still talking about looks compared to just who they are as a footballer player, but it's important now that we're getting these different women that are celebrated, and it's not just the really feminine players. You know, you had your Abby Wambachs, now you have your Andersons, you have these people that are slowly starting just to be recognized because they're great footballers, but I wouldn't say that's happened. I think it's taken a long time for that to happen.
And feels like it's still got some way to go.
Exactly.
But rounding off then, in terms of yourself, I mean, what's next with regards to the coaching? What's the ambition? Or is it still a little bit on pause with everything else that's going on right now?
I think, I mean, the baby needs to hurry up and come out because my coaching license starts in October. So he needs to get a move on. But then it's just about finishing a coaching license this year. And then, again, it's no longer my decision. It's not just me. It's now we really have a family. Before it was Bob's, but now it's really us. And you know, knock on wood, she's been really healthy and she's had a great career. So she's also doing her master's. So if we can stay another year, there's a lot married. But my dream is to be a coach. My dream is to try this. And I think I've gotten some head coaching offers, but I want to be in an environment where I can be an assistant to really learn, because I do think it's just a huge jump from being a player to a coach. Mm-hmm. So for now, it's just going to finish my A license and do that at best. And then hopefully in January, February, we have a better idea of BAFSA's future. And then, you know, we always decide, okay, she has 2 or 3 years to really give this a go, enjoy it. And then maybe it's my turn. And, you know, to be honest, on the outside, the FAWSL is somewhere where I think many coaches are going to want to be, because you see women coaches, you see the support of the league, you see the Euros coming there. And these clubs are already set up because they're with these huge men's teams, which I think you do need to kind of drive it in the right direction.
Last thing then, Doyen Sports, which is the agency that you've co-founded as well. I mean, how has that been sort of working into the agents world as well? Because I suppose it's still relatively new territory in terms of women's football, but something that it arguably needs as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've gotten so many messages like, oh, Ella, you're an agent. And we're not, when we use agency, everybody thinks that we, like, they're saying, oh, you're going to get Zada Bjork to Madrid. I'm like, I'm not their agent. There's the agencies for girls that are done playing football. So we are solely, and now we're solely based in England. Corona has obviously had, everyone had to adapt. But our job is now to try to help these women at the end of their career to try to come into a different career and to just do it without being alone. So again, the adaptation of, you know, Ella's next chapter or Ella asks, these are things that we've just had to kind of throw in because we don't want to go away, but we want to stay relevant and to, we just love football. We love the women's stories. We love their side. We love their journeys, and we love telling this aspect of it. So for us, that's been easy. And now it's just about trying to, as things get slowly moving again, of trying to connect these, okay, a girl knows she wants to retire next year. Let's start putting in place. So when you do want to retire, we can help you out because you should be celebrated. You should have, even if you played at, you know, Everton, Birmingham, you didn't make millions of dollars. Like, you still were a professional athlete, which only a certain percent of people are in this world. So let's help you do this together and build a community to move forward.
Definitely. And something I think that is really needed, because that transition from playing into the rest of your life really is not just a football thing either. So many people can sometimes struggle with that transition and adapting to it as well. So I suppose it's great to see Doyen starting up in that way with that mantra as well, because it's probably sorely needed.
And I also think it's like, I mean, if I was a men's player and I had a 10-year career, you know, I wouldn't have to think about in a year, what am I going to do? But, you know, unless you study, and a lot of people in Europe don't go to school. I mean, I was lucky in the States. I have a bachelor's, you know, a bachelor's degree. But so many of these girls don't go to school because they started playing professional at 17 years old. And there's so many things. You have an injury, you have no idea how it's going to go. And then all of a sudden, maybe you're 25, maybe you're 28, maybe you're 22, 31. And then, okay, you walk into business and you think, oh, where do you have experience? Well, I don't have a degree. I was playing pro football at 17. Okay, well, do you have a lot of income that you can go based off? Well, no, I did it because I loved it. Mm-hmm. They played for my flat, you know? So it's like just trying to maybe think a little bit ahead and then trying to be, no matter what happens, have your bases covered, that you can take what you want and what you truly love that can be your second chapter, which is some with football, some have nothing to do with football, and allow you to transition out.
Definitely. Final question then, and to almost steal one of your titles, what is the title of your next chapter?
Ooh. You're asking me some good questions today. My next chapter title. I don't know. I think the first thing that comes to my head is like, she's done it. And the reason I say that is because I think I've always gotten along better with men in general. And I would love to go into the next chapter of learning from somebody on not necessarily a men's coach, but just somebody that has done it, that gets in to see what it really is to be in behind the scenes of Liverpool for a year, or in behind to Real Madrid, just to see the what it really is like on the men's side that has been in history for so long. And if not that, then just saying an American coming over to help coach in England. I know Denise Reddy has just come over there. But I think that's really the thing of, you never know what's going to happen. You don't know. But I would really love to do the challenge of seeing how hard is it to coaching. And she's somehow navigated her way to work her way up the ladder to do it.
With that, then, I draw this particular episode to an end. But definitely one of our most wide-ranging ones. And I think there's so many important messages to take from that, whether it's people listening, footballers, anyone who's going through anything particularly tough right now, and general coronavirus advice as well with everything that's going on right now. And we managed to get through the entire episode without the baby arriving. So
there's been some movement. I don't know if you guys have noticed me rocking a bit, but I don't know if they're contractions or what, but I appreciate you taking the time as well. I know it was a quick one, but it's been a good a good reflection of the past couple of years, I'd say that.
Yeah, definitely. And likewise, very enjoyable for me as well. So thank you so much, Ella, for coming on. And I'm pretty sure we'll see you in a coaching position sometime very soon.
Fingers crossed.
The Women's Football Diary is brought to you by Sportspiel. You can join the conversation and spread the word using hashtag Women's Football Diary now on social media. You can follow Sportspiel on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram using the handle at SportspielPod and visit our website, which is sportspielonline.com. The Women's Football Diary will return next Friday with a brand new episode featuring West Ham defender Maz Pacheco.